Probe Ministries is engaged in research and communications to harmonize historic Christian truths with each of the academic disciplines. The Probe team and their associates are actively involved in writing and lecturing on issues and topics vital to today's students. Probe lecture teams have been invited to speak on a wide variety of academic topics in classrooms at the University of Vermont, Michigan State University, LSU, the University of Kentucky, DePaul University, Texas Christian University, Oklahoma State University, the University of Colorado, San Diego State University, the University of Saskatchewan, the University of Calgary, and at a host of other university campuses in the United States and Canada. The following lecture was recorded live in a university classroom.
Just here to share with you on the topic elements of the resurrection, and I think this broadly would be described in the spectrum of theological opinion as an evangelical approach to the resurrection based on the documents of the New Testament and the historical evidence that is available. And what I'll do is just sketch, kind of a thumbnail sketch in the first minutes of the direction that I would like to go, and then leave plenty of time for questions, and you could probe more deeply for sources and informations and philosophical presuppositions. I've divided the topic into the following categories. First of all, is the resurrection supernatural? Secondly, is it historical? Thirdly, is it verifiable? Fourthly, is it physical? And fifthly, is it evidential? And I'm going to give a positive answer to all of those questions, so you won't have to be guessing. Is the resurrection supernatural? Whenever you talk about a supernatural event in a post-Humean world, which is the subtitle of my talk, Elements of the Resurrection in a Post-Humean World, you have to address the question of can miracles occur, and what is a miracle? As you know, David Hume said that miracles are not credible or believable because a miracle is something based on the lowest degree of probability. It only happens very rarely, if it happens at all, 0.0001, whereas a natural law is based on the highest degree of probability, 99.999 and going. Now, said Hume, if a natural law is based on the highest degree of probability, stick a guy's head under the water for 5 minutes and he drowns, the next guy does, you assume that there's some kind of causal connection here, and a miracle is based on the lowest degree of probability, the minor premise of his syllogism is the wise man never bases his belief on the lowest probability, he always bases his belief on the highest probability. Therefore, the wise man, the critical, the scientific man, will never believe in miracles. Now, notice two things about Hume's argument. Number one, he doesn't say miracles don't occur. He just said wise men don't believe in them, critical, intelligent men. So Hume never destroyed the possibility of miracles. He just allegedly destroyed the credibility of believing in them. At one place he said it would have to be a greater miracle to not believe in it than to believe in it. Otherwise, someone would not have a credible basis for doing it. Now let's analyze his argument. Does the wise man always believe what is based on the highest degree of probability? If I should say to you I was at a bridge game and a perfect bridge hand was dealt. They were all sown, sound, sane, sober people. I saw it. Four witnesses of it. Now, the odds for a perfect bridge hand are 1 to 635 plus billion against it. Well, one in that many. So the odds are very, very rare. But it did happen. In fact, many times, perfect bridge hands have been dealt many times in the history of bridge, and they're usually reported in the paper now and then. Now, would the wise man believe the probability against it? You say, well, I've got 1 to 635 billion plus odds against it happening. Does the wise man believe the odds against it or the facts for it? I think Hume's problem is that he has predisposed himself against miracles, and no matter what happened, he wouldn't believe in a miracle because he'll always believe the mathematical and a priori and a posteriori odds against it happening rather than the facts for it happening. Now, I commend to you that since Hume, there has been a basic naturalistic presupposition that has controlled biblical exegesis subtly, surreptitiously, stealthily, through the studies that people get. For example, Kittel is not an objective tool. Kittel is a tool that is formulated by existential philosophy that comes out in the exegetical study. So when you pick up Keeler and say, I've got something neutral, there is no such thing as a completely presuppositionless neutral approach to exegesis. So you have to ask yourself, do I come to the New Testament with an anti-supernatural bias, or am I open to look at the facts? I think anyone who's open to look at the facts will conclude that the New Testament claims, you might say the whole thing is a fraud, the New Testament claims that the eyewitnesses and contemporaries of Christ saw a miracle, a resurrected Christ who was a miracle. And if Hume's view does not follow, then it's possible that it could be true. I was talking to a young man once, and I personally verified this myself, and I'll give you the evidence if you're interested. There's a boy by the name of David Pelletier, who when he was about 9 years old, lost the use of his left eye. His father and his friends began to pray for him that his eye would be healed, quote unquote. Well, he lost his eye. They cut it out, and they cut the optic nerves out, and they gave him a glass eye. His father continued to pray for him that his eye would be healed. And his mother said, look, if you want to pray for him, just don't tell anybody. They'll think you're nuts. He prayed for 2.5 years for the boy. 2.5 years later, the boy came out of the bedroom one night and said, Dad, I can see with my bad eye, which is what he called his glass eye. They took him to a doctor, and the doctor covered one eye. He could see. He had depth perception. He has X-ray vision. I've seen this all myself. It's been verified by doctors, Christian or non-Christian, naturalist, supernaturalist, all over the country. Buddhist doctor on Japanese TV said it's a miracle. His name is David Pelletier. He's now about 12, 13 years old. There is no question that the boy sees without an eye, and he has X-ray vision and depth perception. You cover up the right eye. I've personally tested him for about 3 hours myself and asked all sorts of questions. Now, what happens to a naturalist when he looks at this? A naturalist in the Humean tradition says, very interesting. Now we know you don't need eyes to see. Someday we'll be able to see through the end of our elbow and out the end of our finger. Now I commend to you that he has an anti-supernatural blick, what Hare in philosophy called a blick. A blick is, I've got my mind made up, don't confuse me with the facts. It's a miracle. Now, if everything that automatically happens in the world is a natural event, then ipso facto, no miracles can occur. For example, what if the physical body of Jesus of Nazareth resuscitated from Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, which is about as literally as I can put it for you, what if that really occurred? And somebody stuck their finger right in his hand, their hand in his side, and saw all those things that the Gospels say happened, ate fish and all of this. What if that really happened? If David Hume or Anthony Flew or a modern naturalist saw that, they would say something like this, now we know that resurrections are natural events. Now we know that resurrections do occur, but it's not supernatural. And here's the presupposition behind their thinking that I think we must re-examine. The presupposition is whatever happens in the natural world was caused by the natural world. And I commend to you that is an unprovable, scientifically, historically, unprovable presupposition, one. And two, it's an incurable blick. It's an incurable naturalistic bias that there is no way the person, he is not even open to the possibility of a miracle occurring. Now, as I look at New Testament exegetical studies and New Testament scholarship, quote, unquote, that springs primarily from the Boltmanian school, followed by Ogden and the modern followers, there is an anti-supernatural bias that wouldn't believe a miracle if they could stick their finger right in his hand or his hand in Jesus' side because they've accepted this naturalistic bias, and therefore, of course, miracles can't happen. On the other hand, take a look at this situation. There was a guy who went to a psychiatrist, and he believed he was dead. And the psychiatrist was trying to convince him that he was alive. And he couldn't figure out, how am I going to convince this guy that he's really alive and not dead? And so he said to him, do you believe that dead men bleed? And the man said, no, if it's a corpse, it doesn't bleed. The psychiatrist said, I've got the way I can prove to him he's alive. And he took a pin, and he pricked the man's hand, and blood began to trickle out. And the man who thought he was dead looked at the blood on his hand and he said, by Jove, dead men do bleed. He had an incurable naturalistic bias. So if we could overcome Hume's objection, and I think it's overcome by sheer logic, the wise man does not look at a priori probability against the event. He looks at the actual evidence for the event. Is it actually true that David Pelletier can see? Is it actually true with a good, reliable witnesses that Jesus rose from the dead? That's the way to decide whether something is true. You don't legislate what it must mean. You listen to what it is saying. Second thing I'd like to say is about the historical nature of the resurrection. There are many people today who say the resurrection could not be a historical event. It has to be a supra-historical event. It can't be history. It's got to be geschichte. This, of course, comes from Bultmann and many others, traceable back to, in at least roots, to Soren Kierkegaard. And I'd like to analyze that particular objection and show you what I think is the basic fallacy behind it. The basic fallacy behind that event is assuming that if something is more than historical, it has to be less than historical. Now, that's not very profound reasoning. One of the area in which I teach is philosophy, logic, philosophy of religion. And the logic of that is not very profound. Let us suppose that resurrection means more than, and I don't know any Christian who doesn't hold this, whether he's an ardent fundamentalist or an extreme liberal. Every Christian I know believes that there is more to the resurrection than a resuscitated corpse. It has a spiritual meaning. It has a meaning that has theological implications. But just because it's more than historical, does that mean it has to be less than historical? I commend to you that something could be in the time-space world without being of the time-space world. I'll give an example. Human freedom. The result of my free acts are spatio-temporal. But if my free acts are determined by the spatio-temporal world, I'm not free. That certainly wouldn't fit in good with a Wesleyan tradition. It doesn't fit in good, I think, with a Calvinistic tradition either. That man is free. He is not completely determined. He is morally responsible. But an act of freedom is an act in the space-time world, but it's not an act determined by the spatio-temporal world. An act of my mind, an act of subjectivity. I think one of the things the existentialists have shown to us very vividly is that the I cannot be reduced to the me. I am more than my objectivity. Subjectivity transcends objectivity. Now, couldn't you have an act in the objective world that is not of the objective world? Could there not be a subjective act which has objective ramifications and manifestations? I commend to you that that's precisely what the resurrection of Christ is. It is a historical event in the space-time world, and that you can verify the historical aspects, but that the more than aspects, the spiritual and theological aspects, are from beyond the space-time world, and their implications are greater than the space-time world. Third thing I'd like to suggest is that the resurrection is verifiable, and I won't attempt to go into the whole verification. I'll just indicate the direction and a book you might read. If it is an event in the space-time world, then that dimension of the event can be verified. Either there was an empty tomb, either the resuscitated corpse of Jesus of Nazareth was encountered by people after 3 days after the crucifixion for a 40-day period, or it was not. That is a verifiable matter. If the resurrection is supernatural and is historical, then it can be verified. A man by the name of Anthony Flew devised a principle called the falsifiability principle. And he said this: if you don't let anything count against a view, you cannot let anything count for it. He says, I look at Christians and I see them saying, God loves me, even if my wife dies of cancer, my baby is run over by a car, I still say God loves me. And he said, I look at Christians and I say, their view is unfalsifiable. They don't let anything count against it. Okay, now let's turn Flew's falsifiability principle on Flew and the naturalist. They do not let anything count for the biblical perspective that Jesus Christ rose from the dead and that he could be verified by eyewitnesses. Because everything that is used, Flew has this principle, if the event is repeatable, it is verifiable. If the event is unrepeatable, it's unverifiable. Now that view is an unfalsifiable view. He is saying everything that is not repeatable, and resurrections are not repeatable, is unverifiable. If you were out on the golf course with me and you saw me tee off, and you knew what kind of golfer I was, you know, the about the 60s kind of golfer for nine. Don't get excited. And you saw me tee off, and you saw the ball go through the air, hit by the green, and run in the hole. Hole in one. You say, Geisler, repeat it. I don't believe you can do it. Unrepeatable. I'm sorry, I can't do it again. Verified? Yes. Unrepeatable? Sorry, I can't do it. So not everything that is unrepeatable is unverifiable. What is unverifiable is Flew's principle of verifiability and falsifiability. He's got a blick. And he said, I won't let anything count for the resurrection. You say, how about if I can produce 500 witnesses? Some of them stuck their finger right in his hand. Some put their hand in his side. Some saw him eat fish. Some felt his flesh and bones. How about if I can do that over a 40-day period? Flute said, I wouldn't believe anything. Well, then, he's not letting any evidence count against his view. Therefore, he can't let any evidence count for it either. And what we are saying is the resurrection is verifiable. Just for my curiosity here, how many of you in this room have ever read... seriously, not just casually looked at, but have read carefully Frank Morrison's book, Who Moved the Stone? Okay, two of you. I'd highly recommend this book because here is a fellow who was skeptical of the whole thing of can you verify the resurrection. He was indeed a skeptic who wanted to disprove Christianity. And Frank Morrison set out to write a book disproving the resurrection occurred. And here's what happened to Frank Morrison. He wrote a book subtitled The Book That Refused to Be Written. Because when he looked at the evidence historically, not presuppositionally that it can't happen, but historically, open-minded skeptic, he was converted to Christianity and to the belief that Jesus literally rose from the dead and wrote a book defending, the finest defense up until modern times, of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from historical evidence. Frank Morrison, Who Moved the Stone? It's put out by, it used to be put out by Faber, it's now put out by University Press. There's another man by the name of Lord Littleton who did the same thing. Lord Littleton looked into the evidence. He was predisposed against it. He was converted to Christianity and the belief in the resurrection. Sir William Ramsay, who was reared in the German Bauer School and all of its presuppositions, decided to look into the evidence for himself, spent about 20 years or more of his life looking into the evidence. He was converted to Christianity and to belief in the resurrection. A man from Harvard Law School by the name of Simon Greenleaf taught the course on evidence. He wrote the book on legal evidence. And his student said to him one day, he had a couple Christian students, Dr. Greenleaf, have you ever applied legal evidence to testing the New Testament documents and the claim that Jesus rose from the dead? He said, no. So would you do it? And Simon Greenleaf wrote a book entitled The Testimony of the Evangel, in which he shows how he was converted to Christianity and the belief in the resurrection by applying the laws of legal evidence. Now what I'm saying to you is this, if you apply normal legal laws and historical procedures to the resurrection, it is an extremely verifiable event. I'll make a stupendous claim that you can challenge later. The most verified event from the ancient world is the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ. No event from the ancient world has better evidence to verify than that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. You can challenge that later. Fourthly, the resurrection was physical. Now let me give you what I think are the evidences that the resurrection was physical. And I think it's true for Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 as well as for the Gospels, though the evidence I offer is obviously from the Gospels because Paul was not a first-hand witness to the resurrection. But John was, Matthew was, Mark was, and consequently I think the better evidence comes from the Gospels. Here it is, an empty tomb. Now, an empty tomb indicates physical resurrection. Because if the body was never found, if the Roman authorities had it, they could have produced it. If the Jews had it, they could have produced it. If the body was never found, then it was that body that resuscitated. Physical resurrection. Secondly, the grave clothes. When they came into the tomb, the grave clothes were there, apparently in a cocoon-like thing with a napkin laid by itself. The body resurrected right out of those grave clothes. The indication of the grave clothes left behind shows that we've got a physical resurrection. There's no longer a physical body here. It's gone. Thirdly, the moved stone. Why move the stone? The stone was moved, of course, not so Jesus could get out, but so the disciples could come in. But the fact that the stone was moved and they could come in and see this and that there were angels there testifying to the fact that he is not here, he is risen, is an indication of the literalness of this thing so that they couldn't just stand out and say, well, it's kind of spiritual. He's resurrected spiritually. I mean, I don't have to go in and see if the body is there or not, but the spiritual is enough. No, to convince them that it was physical, the stone was rolled away. Fourthly, he ate fish. Now, suppose you took a picture, I'll put it in very literal terms, suppose you had a photographer and you took a picture of the resurrected Christ. Would you see a body? I say yes. You certainly wouldn't see a half a fish. He takes a bite of a fish, and what do you see? Half a fish in midair with teeth marks in it, just hanging there. Ridiculous. They said, but Jesus walked through a wall. I'll get to that in a moment. I suppose if you took a picture of Christ walking through a wall, you'd get a double exposure. And I'll give an explanation of how I think this is possible for a physical body in a moment. He not only ate fish, but he said to the disciples, and this is the fifth evidence, look at my scars. There's continuity there. This scar here is the one I received on the cross. Put your hand in my side. This is where the spear hit me. That's physical. Scars are physical things on physical bodies. Spiritual scars, spiritual holes in the hand, just doesn't make good sense. Finally, he said to the disciples in the Luke account, I've got flesh and bones, I am not a spirit. I've got flesh and bones, I'm not a spirit. Now, of course, the modern critic says, well, yeah, but Jesus never really said these things. These are a couple generations later, things that were said about him, the story's exaggerated, went through form criticism. I hope you're up to date on what you read, because a couple weeks ago in Time magazine, our friend Bishop Robinson, who wrote a book, Honest to God, is here. This is the March 21st, 1977 issue. And Bishop Robinson, who was honest to God, has now become honest to the facts. And you know what the facts are? Every book in the New Testament was written before 70 AD, some of them between 40 and 50 AD, within 10 to 15 years after Christ died, by the eyewitnesses. And he says in the last paragraph, if scholars reopen the question, he is convinced the results will force a rewriting of many introductions to, and ultimately theologies to, the New Testament. The facts are that these documents were written not two or three generations later by people who had exaggerated religious fancy or for ecclesiastical purposes, but by eyewitnesses and contemporaries of the events who said, I ate breakfast with him this morning, I stuck my finger in his hand, my hand in his side, I felt his flesh and bones, he's alive, and who turned the world upside down on the basis of that belief within 30 days, within 40 days of the time it had happened in Jerusalem. Now, I don't think I have to touch on the last point, is this evidential? If that's not evidence, then I don't understand evidence. Okay, I'll throw it open now for any questions that you may have about the question of the elements of the resurrection.
Would you talk a little more about how you reconcile the evidence of Paul in this matter, where he says that the resurrection body is not a physical body, but a spiritual body?
Yes, I want to comment on two things there. First of all, that, what does he mean in 1 Corinthians 15, a spiritual body? I take it that he means a spirit-dominated body rather than a flesh-dominated body. He's not talking about the nature of the body, but the domination or the kind of body this is, in the sense that it's immortal. You've got a mortal body, which is a flesh-dominated body, and an immortal body, which is a spirit-dominated body, which will never die again. What's the difference between the two? Well, I take it from the example of Jesus that the difference is this. A spirit-dominated body can walk right through a wall. Now, is that physically impossible? If it's a physical body, how can it walk through a wall? Scientists tell us that most of our body is empty space. That if you took all of the stuff of the world, 8,000 miles through and 25,000 miles around, all the real stuff of the world, you could put it in the Empire State Building, the rest is empty space. Now, I take it that a resurrection body is a spirit-dominated body that's attuned so that the empty space of the atoms, if you want to use the scientific term, of the body and the wall can coalesce so that they're not, let's say, hitting each other. You could walk right through a wall. That's not a regular flesh-dominated body. That's an unusual spirit-dominated body that is immortal. I take it that the immortal body will never die. I take it the immortal body doesn't have to eat for sustenance, but could eat. And if you take spirit-dominated body from 1 Corinthians 15 and the resurrection occasions of Christ, I think that's perfectly compatible with the scientific facts of what physical means, because physical just means has atomic characteristics, has atoms in it. And the atoms, there are plenty of empty space between the atoms in a body and the atoms of a wall to go like this. The second thing I promised to comment on was... No, I guess that's both of them, but let me say something else about Paul's view. Paul was a Jew. He was trained in the rabbinical tradition. He was a Pharisee. And one of the characteristics, if you study Phariseeism, is the belief in a literal resurrection. Now, to believe that Paul, who believed in the literal resurrection, who saw Christ as a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, who argued for the resurrection out of the Old Testament, Acts 16, proving that Jesus must indeed rise from the dead, and who no doubt used verses like Psalm 16 and Psalm 2, to believe that suddenly a Jew believing in the literal resurrection and finding the fulfillment of his Judaism in Christ and being a contemporary of the apostles who believed the literal resurrection, that he suddenly got a mystical, Gnostic, second century, influenced by Plato, view that the body is not essential, is to me inconceivable. And it's not contextual. The contextual understanding, in the light of Paul and his training and his ministry, would be to understand him as teaching that this body is physical.
For you, literal, identical with physical?
Literal to me is a word that is ambiguous, and you'd have to define it. Physical, I'm willing to say, means has atoms in it. Physical means that if you felt it, you would feel something there. He said, feel me, I've got flesh and bones. Physical means if they gave him something to eat, he could eat it. Physical means tangible, spatio-temporally related, having atomic particles in it. Now, if literal means something else than that to you, then I wouldn't think it would be necessary to call it
An objection that is sometimes raised against the view that you're representing, grounded in the question, what happened to the physically resuscitated body of Jesus?
Okay, as I understand the incarnation, and I'll diagram it this way, as I understand the classic Christian teaching of the Trinity and incarnation, which we link, is that in God there is one what and three who's. Now that roughly is the orthodox view of the Trinity. One God, but three persons, and these three persons are eternally related. Augustine used this illustration. If God is love, he must be a lover, Father, a loved one, and a spirit of love, the Holy Spirit. So God is essentially love, but there are three persons, a lover, a loved one, and a spirit of love. This eternal who assumed from Bethlehem another what. So Jesus has two whats and one who. Or to put it another way, there is one it in God and three I's. This is more Buberian language. God has an eternal I-thou relationship, a community of persons in one nexus or eternal unity. Or let me state that one more way. In God there is one objectivity and three centers of subjectivity. So if you say, what is God? God is one. Who is God? God is three. Now this who eternally related to these other who's in this one eternal what, assumed another what. That what has a physical or bodily dimension. That body he had for, let's say, 33 years. That body went into a grave for 3 days, or part of Friday all day, Saturday, and part of Sunday. That body was resurrected and now is an immortal body that eternally exists with this who. That body is still in existence, this spiritual immortal body, because it can move perhaps at the speed of light or faster, it can immediately appear and disappear. It's got characteristics that our spacemen that are appearing and disappearing in the world now have. It's always interesting to me that man will believe a natural thing, like space people and coming in at tremendous speeds and everything, but they won't believe a supernatural thing that says not really much different than that.